All right. So, what generally is what you might call the theme of Acts chapter 9, which is what we're just wrapping up? Randy?
Conversion of Saul.
Conversion of Saul, who later on we find out is known to us as
Paul.
Okay. So, we have here a man named Saul from what city?
Tarsus.
Originally from the city of Tarsus. Where is that? Like South L.A. or what?
Up north.
Yeah, up north. Yeah. Okay, it's up in Asia Minor, right on the southern coast, as it were. Just sort of around the corner when you go around that bend that takes you into Asia Minor. Tarsus is right, not too far, about that far. So... I think Mickey had a couple of slides last time that indicated how far it was, but I don't remember them. So, anybody knows, you can speak right up. Anyway, so we see that the chapter starts off with Saul in one frame of mind and ends up with Saul in a different frame of mind. Well, almost ends up. There are other things in chapter 9. What's the other thing in chapter 9 that's important that doesn't have to do with Saul? Okay, Tabitha and the healing of Aeneas. All right, so, and that was by Peter. Okay, so we have this, most of it's about Saul, and then we have a little bit about Peter and the two things that he's doing there. Now, as we see, and as we pointed out a couple of times, we see that at the end of this chapter, that Peter, who is an apostle, right, is doing a couple of miracles there, one healing a palsied man and another one raising Tabitha or Dorcas from the dead. But have we seen other people that are not apostles doing miracles? Yep. Haven't we in Acts chapter 8? Right. So, Philip, Chris?
Not about Philip, but about Peter performing that miracle. I find it interesting that, you know, at one point in time, we don't know which apostles Jesus was referring to, but they were not able to cast out the demon. And Jesus at that time talked about you couldn't cast it out because of your lack of faith.
Right.
And here, you know, both in Acts chapter 3 and here again in Acts chapter 9, we see the faith of Peter not only to heal a man, but now to raise someone from the dead.
Yep. Right.
How much his faith had grown.
Yes, Peter's faith had grown. And changed, as it were, right? He became less, what do you call it when a person does things on the spur of the moment?
Huh?
Impulsive. Less impulsive, impetuous, and more attuned to the gospel, as it were. Matter of fact, Jesus, when he was speaking to those folks, he said, if you had what faith is a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, be removed and tossed into the sea, and it would obey you. So he did not minimize, certainly, the possible power of miracles if necessary. Now, obviously, it wasn't necessary to cast a mountain into the sea. Therefore, there wasn't any need for him to demonstrate that. So, all right. So as we get on then through Acts chapter 9, we realize that things are happening. It's interesting to note, I don't know whether you noticed or not, but just when we get down into the summarization place, you notice that we're going to summarize Acts chapter 9, verse 30, and then we'll go on to verse 32. But it's interesting to note that verse 31 is not included in there. But what does verse 31 tell us?
The church enjoyed peace.
Right. So the church enjoyed peace at that time. After Saul of Tarsus had quit running amok amongst them, and so it said the church throughout all Judea, Galilee, and Samaria had peace, being edified and walking in the fear of the Lord, and the comfort of the Holy Spirit was what?
Multiplied.
Right. So now we have the church increasing, continuing to increase as it had before. All right, so let's go on to the questions. Does anybody need a question sheet? There's a few left up here on the front. We'll go with no. All right. All right, so we want to, on the question sheet, go through the summarization first And of course, as Mickey says, we just want a one sentence explanation, explanatory summary of this. Now, I don't care how many semicolons you have in it. All right. So, Acts 9 verses 1 through 9. I did it in like 10 words. Yes, Carolyn.
Saul travels to Damascus to persecute Christians and then is confronted by Jesus and blinded.
Okay. All right. I just put down Jesus speaks with Saul on the road to Damascus. So it leaves out a lot of important points, though. Yeah, that's good. A good summary there. So as we go on to the next one, they go verses 10 through 19. Then what do we have here? Now Saul is in Damascus, right?
Saul's conversion.
Yeah, the conversion of Saul. Okay. Who's sent? And by whom is he sent? Well, I think we can see that it's Jesus in the discussion that is being said there. If we, yeah, for he has him that laid that, but to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings in verse 15. Of course, it still could be God. It still could be God, but I mean, obviously, they're both God. So, anyway, the Lord, one of the Lords, anyway, has sent him. And so, Ananias was what?
Hesitant.
He's a who?
Oh, you're asking about, I was saying hesitant. But.
Well, he was hesitant, but as a person, what was he?
He was a Jew. Christian.
He was a Christian.
Jewish Christian.
Okay. So, whether he's a Jewish Christian, I don't know. Does it say in there? It does say that he was one of the disciples. So, he probably says Brother Saul, doesn't he, somewhere? Yeah. Not in this one. I think it's one of the other.
A certain disciple. It just starts out a certain disciple.
Yeah. But if we go to 22 and 26, we may find other things. I think one place, though, it says Brother Saul.
Verse
17. 17 of this one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Brother Saul, the Lord, even Jesus, who appeared unto thee by the way, which thou camest, hath sent me. There you go. So it was Jesus. All right, doesn't make any difference. So yeah, and then as we go through 20 to 22, what do we have here? Another. Where are we again? We're still in Damascus, right? And what's going on? Verses 20 through 22.
Saul goes to the synagogue and preaches and teaches Christ.
All right, so he preaches the gospel. Is that what you had, Donna? Okay. All right. If anybody's got wants to expound on any of these, you know, we can add sentences together. So if you got one sentence, you got another sentence. I mean, we can have a whole bunch of sentences. Still only have
right here.
So, still only have one sentence. So where were we? 20-22, 23-25.
Add one more thing to 22.
Okay.
Jesus, Paul was proving that Jesus is the Christ. That's what it says.
Well, that's true, yeah.
He was proving that Jesus was the Christ.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a
strong.
Very strong and important passage. I guess the only way you could prove it was with scriptures.
Proving that this is the Christ, yeah, that's right. In verse
22.
Yeah.
So he was highly motivated.
He was, exactly. He seems to have made quite a turn. Well, perhaps this is where we get the idea. He saw the light. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's the etymology of that particular term. So, yeah.
I just always imagined that during that 3 days of blindness, he was thinking a lot. And he was probably going back through all the scriptures he knew.
Yeah.
And seeing how the applications applied.
Right.
And coming to the realization.
Yeah.
I've been doing the wrong thing.
Kind of, what have I missed here? Yeah, so, yeah, it'd be interesting to speak to Paul now and find out what was going through his mind at that time. But obviously it was certainly enough to convince him that something was wrong with his previous lifestyle, his previous life. All right, have we looked at 23 to 25 yet? Now what's that?
Saul escapes death threat via a basket.
Via a basket. All right. Was that seven words? Perfect. Yeah. All right. So they take him out on a donkey cart through the city gate, right? What'd they do? Lowered him in a basket down the side of the wall. I guess at that time, oh, that didn't work out very well. At that time, you'll remember that apparently the houses, some houses were like built on the side of the wall, because what was Rahab commanded to do in Jericho? Yeah, put the red ribbon out the window, right? And so they would be able to see her from the outside of the city.
Did you? And the scripture says it was nighttime, and if I'm not mistaken, the city gates usually were closed at night. Mm-hmm. So this would have been, besides, if they were, watching the gates at night anyway,
right,
to catch him, so this would have been a good
one. Yeah. Yeah, silly people weren't watching all the windows on the outside of the out of the wall. I don't know why. Anyway. All right, 26 through 30 then. We have a change of venue here, as it were. All right, where in 26 through 30, where do we head off to now? Off to Jerusalem, and what's that about? And there's, then there's no problem with that, right? They just, yeah.
They don't like him.
Yeah, yeah. There's other people there that don't like him even more. That's right. So the the disciples at Jerusalem are reluctant to take him in with open arms just right away. Why is that? Seems he had a bad rep, right?
They heard the same thing that Ananias heard.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And not even just heard. I mean,
well, sure. They were saying people dragged away to prison. Yeah.
They're wondering if he's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Exactly.
If this is some plot to infiltrate the church and destroy it from
right
inside out.
Yeah. Yeah. Donna.
He was declared by Barnabas to be preaching Jesus.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting to note that Barnabas here takes up his case. Where have we seen Barnabas before? Right. It was just before the Lydon died in 5, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, that's where we've seen this Barnabas, and now we see him again. As near as I can tell, there's no reason for us to know that Barnabas has any more insight into this man than anybody else does, but apparently he's willing to listen to him or something. There's nothing said in the scripture about why Barnabas takes up his case as opposed to anybody else that did that. All right. Verse 30. We have another change of venue here. Where are we going now? Did he go through Caesarea on the way also?
Yeah, they brought him down to Caesarea.
Okay. Then send him back home, right? Why did they do that?
Death threats.
Death threats. By other Christians? By the Jews. Okay. So the Christians there had accepted him. And as we get down further in the questions, we see verses 25 and 26. He says, they let him down through the wall, lowering him in a basket. Verse 26, and when he was come to Jerusalem, he essayed to join himself to the disciples. How much time is between verses 25 and 26? According to Galatians, it's like 12 years, right?
This is Damascus, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was in Damascus, and that's where he was escaping.
Right, right. So in 20, whatever I said it was.
Hasn't 3 years passed in Damascus? I spent 3 years in.
Well, if we go to Galatians, which is one of the ones that's cited in the questions, which is Galatians 1:17. Let's look at that real quick.
Oh, okay. Okay, so Arabia is where he's.
Yeah. So starting in Galatians 1:15, it says, "But when it was the good pleasure of God who separated me even from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son in me that I might preach him among the Gentiles, straightway I conferred not with flesh and blood, neither went I up to Jerusalem to them that were apostles before me, but I went away into Arabia, and again I returned unto Damascus. Then after 3 years I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and tarried with him 15 days. Wait, where did I get the 12 years?
Chapter 2, verse 1.
Sue, what?
Chapter 2, verse 1.
Chapter, oh yes, 14 years. Okay, all right. I went up again to Jerusalem. Okay, oh, so I'm sorry, my mistake. For some reason I always ping on this 14 years and don't see that, but. Yeah, so it looks like he was in, at least he was in Arabia and Damascus for 3 years. Okay, so it looks like what happened was is that after he was, thrown out of the window over the wall, he went down to Arabia for about 3 years and then came back to Damascus and then went to Jerusalem. Now, of course, you can see in verse 17 of Galatians 1, if it says, "Neither went I up to Jerusalem to them that were apostles before me," that, of course, indicates that if that were the case, he's talking about meeting with the apostles. He certainly could have gone to Jerusalem and not met with the apostles, though they were there in the church in Jerusalem. So I can't imagine that he would attempt to join himself to the church in Jerusalem, and the apostles wouldn't have some cognizance out of that, and he wouldn't know who they were. So, as we go back then to Acts chapter 9.
Can you explain Galatians 1:18 then?
But I just left Galatians. 1:18. So, alright. So, when he talks in verse 16, about revealing his son in me. That sounds like his conversion to me. Okay. And then he says that, talking about preaching to the Gentiles, he didn't go to Jerusalem, but he went to Arabia and then he returned to Damascus. And then after 3 years in Damascus, he went up to Jerusalem to visit, Cephas or Simon or Peter, right? And tarried with him 15 days. Is that so? But other of the apostles saw I none save James, the Lord's brother. So the only apostle apparently that he met with was Peter. Now James, the Lord's brother, that's not what we would call one of the 12. That was simply a person that had become a Christian and is a person that was sent forth. But he's not, the word apostle is used several times in the New Testament to refer to people who are not of the 12, original or, well, 13 apostles total, you know. So we had the original 12, then we had the addition of Matthias, and then we had the addition of Paul later on, okay. As far as those people who had seen the risen Christ and were appointed by Jesus to be his, I don't want to say, well, personal apostles, can we use that term? But this is one of the usages of the word apostle in the New Testament. There's a couple of other instances where the word apostle is used simply to indicate that this is a person that went forth to preach the gospel.
So in Acts 9, verse 27, it says, "But Barnabas took hold of him and brought him to the apostles and described to them how he had seen the Lord on the road."
Oh, okay. So there, you see the plural there.
Yeah, so Galatians is saying he's only human, one apostle.
Yeah, because he does say when he talks about that he was talking to them privately before them who were of repute, lest by any means I should be running or had run in vain. We see at that time he's talking about people who are most likely the apostles, though there could, he could always also be talking to chief people that are there in the congregation at Jerusalem. So these are most likely other accounts, I mean other occasions of when this happened. Randy, and then Carolyn.
Reading further in Galatians 2, and I haven't studied this in depth, but this kind of sounds like when the time when he goes and Barnabas takes him and convinces the others, because of several things that are said here. Others had, verse 4, because of the false brethren secretly brought in and sneaked in to spy out our liberty. And there's some things in there that make it sound like this is the occasion where they have to convince him.
For Barnabas, was it introducing him to the church? I think.
Because it says, where did it go? Verse 9, and recognizing the grace that had been given to me, James and Cephas and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, so that we might go to the Gentiles and they to circumcise.
By this time, though, yeah, I'll get to you in just a second. By this time, as I understand it, Paul and Barnabas are both essentially members of the church in Antioch. And so when at this place that the elders, I mean the people gave them the right hand of fellowship, I'm thinking they're accepting what they had to say as messengers of the gospel, understanding that they are members of the church in Antioch of Syria. Because Barnabas and Saul went to Antioch of Syria and were there for quite a while.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what they're talking about here when it talks about giving them the right hands of fellowship. Because Barnabas, if he'd been still a member of the church there in Jerusalem, would have already had the right hand of fellowship, as it were. Randy.
In Acts chapter 9, verse 23, it says, when many days had elapsed, the Jews plotted together to do away with him. My understanding is those many days is when he went to Arabia. It says he, in verse 22, kept increasing in strength, confounding the Jews who lived in Damascus by proving that this Jesus was the Christ. When many days had elapsed, the Jews plotted. My understanding is he went to Arabia and came back to Damascus. And then we see how he left Damascus in Basra.
That certainly could be also, yeah.
And then,
because it does talk about the many days were fulfilled.
And he goes straight to Jerusalem. And Barnabas introduces him to the apostles in Arabia, and then he escapes Jerusalem because he's got brethren that want to kill him there. They send him to Tarsus. Well, what we read about in Galatians chapter 2 is the second visit that we read about in Acts chapter 15.
Yeah.
When Paul and Barnabas went to Jerusalem to try and settle the argument about circumcision.
Right.
And that's what's discussed here. Galatians chapter 2. That's my understanding.
It seems reasonable. I mean, if I was Mickey, I'd draw circles on the board and we'd have lines all over the place. But I think that if we go through this carefully, we can find a fairly good sequence of events that seems to fit. And I hadn't thought about that after many days. I mean, 3 years is not a huge amount of time. And so to talk about when many days were fulfilled does not seem unreasonable to say that this could have been the 3 years that he was in Arabia, because then it says he went back to Damascus. Yeah, and you go, and then the Jews aren't going to do anything? I mean, 3 years ago, they weren't particularly happy with him, and now he's going to come back to Damascus and everything's happy days? No. Yeah, so indeed that may exactly be what's going on here. Juan, does that sort of answer your question or just bring up more?
No, not at all. I did like in 25... Between 25 and 26 is lower than the basket, and begin 26 it just says when he came to Jerusalem.
Right.
I mean, all of us would make the assumption it happened right after another, but when
yep.
it says when he came, so a lot could have happened between those
right.
two times.
Yep.
But yeah, because like, the way it's written, we're all sitting there going, "Oh, it happened right away."
Right away. Right.
It's the next sentence, so.
Yeah. And of course, remember that as Mickey has explained previously, when you asked the question about why are the versions different in 9, 22, and 26? 22 and 26 is Paul's reciting the things that he has gone through, whereas here in Acts chapter 8, Luke is giving the history.
9.
Did I say 8? 9, yes. Here in Acts chapter 9, Luke, the recorder of these incidents, is giving the history. And so, in a lot of instances, we'll see that Luke, I don't want to say abbreviates, it's not the Reader's Digest version, but I mean, he summarizes, right? That, you know, he's not doing a day-by-day version of what's going on with Saul of Tarsus here. So,
it doesn't even seem to be the thing, play-by-play is not the purpose of Acts.
No, right.
So Luke is probably, you know, and he may not be previous. You ever tell a story and leaves some stuff out, and then later on you're like, yeah, well, you're really explaining it.
Yeah, you tell it a few different times, and it's different every time.
Would that happen in the New Testament? How are these books written? By the inspiration of God.
Well, what I mean is, when you tell a story, you're not telling anything wrong. You just don't tell every single detail every time.
Right, right, right. So, we see that in the Gospels all the time. You know, this happened and that happened, and you go, well, wait a minute. When Mark told it, it was something else. But it was just that we're not going through, as you say, we're not going through point by point in everything. I mean, there would be no reason for four Gospels if all four Gospels were exactly the same.
Right.
So,
and written for the same reasons.
Right. To the same audience and all that.
Plus, you've got, he kind of jumps ahead in time.
Yeah.
And then in verse 32, he's, okay, you know, meanwhile back at the ranch, here's what Peter was up
to. Yeah, right, exactly. Yep. Yeah. It's the Western version. That's right. I don't think there's any y'alls in here, so it's not a Southern version. So. 30. Did we talk about 30 to great length already? Yes. Okay. All right. And we all. I already mentioned that 31's not in our. For some reason, it's not in the worksheet. But it talks about the church in that local area, Judea, Galilee, and Samaria, that was being at peace and being edified. So. That's nice to know. People had already gone out, though, to preach the gospel. Juan, and then Chris.
Just funny, it says 2630, 39 says 30.
Oh. Yes, you're right. Is that, did I do that, or no? Somebody else did that. Okay. Chris, you had something?
I just had one thing about verse 31 and the peace that the church enjoyed. And I heard it said that they enjoyed peace because you know, Saul's not persecuting them anymore. He may not be, but I don't know that there is anything to suggest that the entire Greek persecution that started in Acts chapter 8 has ceased.
Well, no, yeah, that's right. They were trying to kill Paul, right?
Right, and so when I read there in verse 31 that they were enjoyed peace, just staying within the context of that verse, to me, what drove the peace is what follows those words when it says being built up and going on in the fear of the Lord. It wasn't something external to them that created the peace. It was what happened within them that created the peace, that they were strengthened, they were edified, they were made more zealous by the actions of Saul, by the actions of Barnabas, and again, by everything that happened. So, again, I don't know that it was the absence of persecution, but it was their own faith, their own edification, their own zeal.
Okay, sure.
That I think created the peace.
Right, and certainly peace within the church, because we see that in some instances in later times and things like that, there's not peace within the church. You know, people are, but yeah, the strengthening of the disciples would bring you peace. And Paul mentioned peace several times in the New Testament as he wrote. Yet he talks about the trials and tribulations he went through, right? And he called them, what did he call them?
Light
afflictions. Called them light afflictions. So Paul had peace, even though we wouldn't look at his life and say, that was a peaceful life. It was not a peaceful life. So, but yeah, that's a good point, that the internal peace that we have through, as the scripture there uses, being edified and built up in the gospel will bring us peace to ourselves. All right, yeah, I'll change that because it should say 9:31, shouldn't it? And then if we go on to 32 through 35, what do we have there? Now we're not only changing venues, we're changing peoples. Who we got now? Peter. And what's this particular episode here? 32 to 35. All right. So he goes to Lydda, which is up the coast, and in the slides that we've got.
Well, Joppa is the seaport, then there's Lydda, and then there's Jerusalem.
Oh, okay. So Lydda's a bit inland, and then Joppa's, okay, and that's where he goes next. So Joppa is down from Lydda?
It looks like on the map that Jerusalem, you come down a little bit, there's Lydda, and you come down a little bit more at an angle to the coast.
Oh, okay. All right. Anyway, so Peter has it says that he was gone about through the regions there. Verse 32, he went throughout all parts, and he came to the saints that dwelled at Lydda. So if he was going through all parts, it appears to me that he was most likely preaching the gospel as he was going through. It's not reasonable to think that, you know, Peter was going on vacation and thought he'd visit this and end up at Lydda. We understand then that Peter went to Lydda, and at that place. Now, as we look carefully at the words here, though, it says he came to the saints that dwelled at Lydda, and it says, and there he found a certain man named Aeneas. So we cannot naturally assume that Aeneas was a Christian. He just said that he found a certain man. He came to the saints. And then it says, and he found a man who'd been 8 years palsied. Aeneas could be a Christian, but I don't think it's a necessary inference. But he heals this man. And we see also that those that dwelt at Lydda and Sharon saw him, and they turned to the Lord. So when they saw this miracle, they turned to the Lord. Carolyn.
It might be reasonable.
Yeah. Don't know how big this town was, and it does say that he went to the Christians there, and all of a sudden he goes to the Christians and here's a man. So it could very well be a man amongst the brethren. So, yeah. So anyway, so he, yes.
I just think it's interesting that in these two recitations here, one right after the other, where Peter heals this, or raises this woman from the dead, and heals this palsied man, but specifically in the palsied man, he says, Jesus Christ healed you. And a lot of times somebody will say, you know, these people that do the faith healing thing take that credit.
Oh, yeah.
And he specifically says in this instance.
Yeah.
He says that's where the power comes from.
A good point, yeah. To say that Aeneas, Jesus Christ healeth thee, is a very... forcefully points out to us who does the healing. Randy.
Back it up to 32.
32.
Now, as Peter was traveling through all those regions, the last time we saw Peter was over at the end of chapter 5, right after the apostles had been flogged.
Oh, yeah.
And it says that in verse 41, they went on their way from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. And every day in the temple and from house to house, they kept right on teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ. So that's really, you know, we read about the choosing of the seven after that. But,
yes.
The focus goes away from Peter and the rest of the apostles. But we can only assume that that's what they've been doing.
Right. So at the end of 5, says they continued teaching and preaching. Yeah.
So that's what he's doing traveling through those regions. Is
right.
Teaching and preaching.
Yeah.
And, well, it says in the temple and from house to house, probably in the synagogues. Either way, he was preaching.
Right. Yes, he was. Yes. So, all right. makes me want to bring up a map, but every time I do that, I have to change my properties on my machine here. So, I won't do that. Let me see. So, that's Aeneas. And then in 36 through 43, of course, is the one that most of us are more familiar with. If someone came up to you and said, who's Aeneas? You go, yeah, Yeah, that's in there somewhere. But when we say Dorcas or Tabitha, then everybody goes, oh yeah, I know about that. So, but maybe it's just the magnitude of the miracle or something. But there is certainly a lot more said about Tabitha than there is said about Aeneas. Now, when we look at, so what's 36 through 43? I haven't given it away, have I? It's the raising of Tabitha. All right. And so, but here we know that Tabitha was for what? She was a Christian, because it says there that she was. And, pardon?
She was faithful.
Faithful, and all the folks there loved her, right? Because she was one of these giving persons. She made the baby blankets and stuff like that. Full of good works and alms deeds, which she did at the end of verse 36.
She wasn't a couch potato,
she was a worker. She was a worker, yeah. Reminds you of Proverbs 31, perhaps. They brought unto him into the upper chamber in verse 39, and all the widows stood by him weeping, showing the coats and garments which Dorcas made while she was with them. So she was quite the person to help take care of other people. And as we realize, there are always people in congregations that need to be taken care of, and there's always one or two people that are the ones that spend a good portion of their time taking care of those people, because they have that heart to do something like that. And Dorcas was one of those people. Now, she was pretty sick, and in that she was dead. And so, how did Peter happen to get to where she was, though? Excuse me?
They sent a couple of guys to go get him.
Right. So Lydda was apparently very close to... Oh, so 10 or 15 miles. That's like a day's journey almost. Yeah. So, they had heard that Peter was there at Lydda, and they sent a couple of people up there from Joppa to go get him. And say what?
They said, don't delay.
Don't. Yeah, that's right. And now... It appears that if we just go in the context of what's going on here, we notice in verse 37, she fell sick and died. And they laid her in an upper chamber. And then in verse 36:8, it says, as Lydda was nigh unto Joppa, the disciples sent two men to him, entreating him, delay not to come unto us. So, as near as I can tell, she was dead before they even sent for him.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of faith in Peter here. But of course, if we look, as was mentioned, if we look up in the verses above, we see that it's Jesus Christ that heals. Anyway, so Peter then comes down to Joppa. Randy?
Kind of similar to what Lynn was saying about the healing of Aeneas. He says, Jesus Christ heals you. Make sure that Jesus gets the credit.
Yeah.
Down here, it never says Peter raised her from the dead.
Oh.
It says Peter prayed.
Oh, yeah.
And then looked at her and said, arise. Well, Peter didn't bring her back to life.
No.
God brought her back to life.
Right. Yeah.
He used Peter as an instrument to do this work. But the important thing in both instances is that it made people believe. And it did what the purpose of miracles is, to confirm the word.
Yes.
And he's a preacher.
Yep. And there's...
By being able to be the instrument, God's instrument, to heal the sick and to raise the dead, people believe what he said.
Yeah, right. And yeah, no matter how the miracle is done, it's obviously always Jesus, God, that's doing the miracle. If we look at, is it Elijah or Elisha, that when the little boy died of the woman, and he went and laid himself down on top of the little boy? Was it Elijah? And raised him from the dead. We can't come to the conclusion that Elijah knew CPR and he realized that this kid needed a little resuscitation. He took some actions that where he touched the boy and things like that, and then he was raised from the dead. But it didn't have anything to do with his power. It had to do with the power of God to perform miracles. Yeah. And I think a lot of the prophets that did a certain amount of miracles, they did not take these miracles upon themselves, but gave credit to where credit was due, I think. James?
Well, you know, just kind of piggybacking on what Randy was saying there, what just comes out here is the Bible talks about the faith of Abraham and how he's an example for us. Abraham believed God enough that he believed he could raise his son from the dead, so he drew back with that knife. These people believed that Tabitha could be raised from the dead. They're showing the kind of faith that Abraham had, and that's a profound example for us of the kind of faith we need to have.
Yeah.
In what God said. Now, the dead are not raised today, but someday that will happen at the second coming. So we should put our faith in that and trust
yeah.
in that.
We were just discussing, was it Chris in your class, where it says, your faith heals you. It was a miracle. I'm trying to remember it now, which one it was. But, you know, the thing is, and I think it's Jesus saying to this man, because the person went up to him and asked to be healed, and says, your faith heals you. Once again, we still don't understand that it's the power of that man. It's much like what Peter and James, was it, that healed the man in the third chapter of Acts? Says that it was nothing within us that did this. It's Jesus Christ that does these things. And so that's an important thing for us to remember. Juan?
Just the contrast, I think also has to do with the audience that is present. Because the first man, I mean, we don't know anything, but that kind of tells you that there was probably people there, of course, that have no belief in what he did or what he does or anything like that. So when you tell them, Christ heals you. And then with her, I'm assuming that everybody there was, well, at least mostly everybody was there, was people that believed in him. So,
yeah.
You know, so kind of, you don't have to necessarily say that because they know of what he believes and what his power is. So.
But indeed, a lot of people that do good works, as it were, don't just do them for the people of the church. You know, they might do them for people around them. You know, and so there might have been people there to pay their respects who weren't Christians, that, and they saw something that was really powerful as far as, and I think that it does, well, in verse 42, it became known throughout all Joppa and many believed on the Lord. So there could be people there that were not part of the church, that saw this happen. Well, certainly everybody heard about it. And, that was a good thing. Yes, Carolyn.
Was the thing you were referencing about the faith, Luke 7, verse 50, he said to the woman, your faith has saved you, go in peace. It's after the woman anoints his feet and wipes her hair.
Oh.
That sounds
like it. So it must have been just in my daily reading, because I'm in about that area. So, okay. Yeah. So your faith heals you, he said to the woman who had, that was the one where he talked to the person that had invited him and said, you didn't offer to wash my feet and you didn't give me a kiss when I came in, but she hasn't stopped from, you know, washing my feet with her tears and drying them with her hair and kissing my feet. So, yeah. All right. And it wasn't obvious that this woman had anything to be healed of. But what did he do? He forgave her of her sins. So that was an important thing to know. All right. So, yep, we've zipped right through these summaries here. And go to identify the people. And we should be able to get to maybe one before we... and so once again, you know, Mickey says, just a one-sentence thing. Who's Saul?
The instrument of God.
Say that again.
A chosen instrument of God.
Yes, he certainly is.
He went from being the persecutor to the persecuted.
Yeah, right. Okay, so Saul of Tarsus, of course. This is not any of the other Sauls that we have in the Bible. So when we talk about Saul here in chapter 9, we're talking about the man that started off persecuting the Christians and ended up being persecuted by the Jews. All right. Ananias.
Teaches Saul.
He teaches Saul. Oh. Somebody has mentioned this once. What What did he do in his conversation with Jesus? What did Ananias say back to him? You got the right guy here? Yeah, right. So, you know, it's a matter of, no, wait a minute, you're going to question God here? So, but, you sure, you know, maybe it's another Saul you're talking about, you know, the one over here in this other house. Yeah. So, yeah, Randy.
You don't really sense any argument.
No, no.
It's kind of like thinking out loud.
Right, right. Well, it's much like...
That guy that wants to kill me?
Yeah, that one? Okay, just want to verify here. Yeah, right. Well, it's kind of like when Mary was told that she was going to have the Savior. And she says, how can I, having not known a man? Now, it wasn't an accusation on her part. It was just a, what? How's this going to happen? So, yeah, I'm sure that Ananias had to be somewhat shocked at what was said here, that you know who this guy is, right? So, yeah. Anyway. Okay. One more. Jews, this is a very specific thing. It's not generic at all, is it? Who are we talking about here when we talk about the Jews? All right. So we have two venues here, as it were. We have both Damascus and Jerusalem. And they plot to kill Saul. For what? Why?
He's a turncoat.
And he spends his time doing what now? Preaching this gospel that we don't agree with. Yeah. So, yeah.
He's stirring up trouble.
He's a troublemaker. Tommy.
Generally, the Jews, when they talk about the Jews, it's the people who have not been converted to Christianity.
Well, that's true, yes. Right. And it's interesting to note in the New Testament in a couple of places where it mentioned, where I think it's mostly is Paul that's talking about it. He never refers to what we refer to as Jewish Christians. He calls them Christians. And they were Christians that used to be Jews, but they're not Jews anymore. So we have a tendency to think of Jews as a race, when in fact it's a religion. Randy.
Prior to chapter 11, they're just called disciples.
Disciples, that's correct. Yeah. That was a big argument amongst the people in the 1800s about whether we should be called disciples or Christians. Yeah. Wow. Okay.